Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Mike and Lori Kehoe, and we have Randall Dunn on the line with us, and we're going to talk to him about his Red Ryder series and a bunch of other stuff that he has coming up. And first of all, welcome, Randall. We're glad to have you here.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here. Hi, Lori. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
So let's...
You're the invisible man in the background who makes everything actually work.
I got a face that's perfect for radio. Most handsome face in radio.
Right.
Just want to remind everybody that Randall does have a written interview on our website, www.lorettakehoe.com. That's LauretaKehoe.com. But we wanted to get more into Randall's life and give him more time to talk about things. First of all, Randall is from Elgin, Illinois, which to us is great because we're from Chicago. So nice to meet somebody from the hometown area.
Yes.
Yeah, I live in Elgin, and I've actually lived here for a while. I grew up in Champaign, Illinois, and I moved up to Elgin. I actually attended Judson College. Now it's called Judson University, but it's a Christian liberal arts school where I studied acting. And after I graduated, I just stayed in the Elgin area. And I've been up a little over, I think, about 30 years, a little more. And I've been married for 21 years as of yesterday.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And we have two adopted kids.
Wow.
Yes, our daughter Abby is 8. I'm sorry, our daughter Abby is 12, and our son Noah is 8.
Well, they must keep you busy.
Yes. Yeah, very busy. And now that they're older, especially Abby, she does a lot of things with the YMCA with dance. And she's also been going to Boys and Girls Club a lot lately, and she's volunteering to work with a dance group that they're doing something for there now. So she likes that a lot.
So you talked about you studied acting. What kind of performances have you done? Tell us about your acting career.
Sure. Well, and of course, you know, having an acting when you're going to a liberal arts school that is a private school of 500 or so people, it's a lot easier to get cast in big roles because there aren't that many people competing for them. But in college, I'm trying to think of what shows we did there. We did Mornings at 7, which was a big deal. We did Enemy of the People. Trying to think. I remember more when I first started getting into acting was in high school, my last 2 years of school. And the second play that I was cast in where I had the lead, well, it's sort of the lead role. It's not the title role. It was the play Dracula. And I was playing Jonathan Harker, who I described to people as playing lead victim. Because he's a real estate broker who goes to, you know, conduct a real estate deal with Dracula, not realizing that Dracula is trying to take over all of England. And then he finds out at the end of the first act what's really going on, but it's too late by then and he's trapped. But I actually discovered from that play that I really love the way a vampire story works as a thriller. Because... Mm-hmm. Stories like that, you know, I think that's kind of cemented what has drawn me to stories that have monsters in them. Because in the story Dracula, or any type of vampire story in that vein, no pun intended, but in any type of vampire story, you've got this vampire who's a demon that is just indestructible, and you need an army to defeat him. But instead, you've got this handful of people who don't have an army because nobody will believe them about a vampire existing. So therefore, instead of an army, you've got maybe 5 or 6 people who are dedicated to stopping this unstoppable monster, which makes mm-hmm. them extremely desperate. They're going to do anything to stop this monster. So normally they're very polite, law-abiding citizens, but all of a sudden they're willing to steal, you know, a motorcycle to go chase after a vampire. They're willing to, you know, break and enter, lie, cheat, do whatever they have to do because it's necessary. And so it's very much like the Untouchables movie with Sean Connery and Kevin Costner, where he says, what are you willing to do to stop Al Capone? He says, because you're not going to be able to do it by the normal rules. You can't do it nicely or even necessarily legally, but it has to be done. And that makes you really discover what a person's made of, you know, what kind of a character they really are and what they're willing to sacrifice in order to conquer an evil, you know, demon or an evil person.
I like that. We're big fans of that movie and vampire stories too, but that's a really well spoken piece there. I really like that.
Thanks.
How has that translated into your writing?
Well, I think that I am not actually a horror movie fan at all. Most of the popular horror movies just creep me out. But I've come to really deeply appreciate literary horror, which is totally different from what people think of when they think of the word horror, because they think, oh, you mean like those horror movies like Friday the 13th and Halloween and everything, because that's what we see defined as horror. Horror is actually a pressure cooker for heroes, and it makes you discover what somebody's made of, just like I said in Dracula. So, for example, people don't realize that, you know, some of these classic horror stories like Dracula and Frankenstein, those aren't scary to us anymore, but they are definitely horror stories because they involve a monster as the challenge. And the thing about a horror story is that it is not that you have something that's horrific and scary to the reader or the viewer. It's that it's scary and overwhelming to the characters in the story. So they become desperate because they have very limited options. In a horror story, you only have three options. Either you have to completely destroy the monster that's threatening you, or you have to permanently escape from that monster, or the monster wins and destroys you. So the problem that most people have with horror is that Hollywood movies always choose the third, not always, but usually they choose the third option. They want Freddy Krueger to win. That way they can have billions of sequels. So, but in the best horror, the good guys win. And the good guys win by doing things that they never thought they'd be capable of doing. So a couple of great examples to me, the movie Duel it was Steven Spielberg's TV movie that looks like a real movie. That does not have a monster in it. It doesn't have anything supernatural in it. It's a killer who's behind a truck, but he has a supernatural sense about him because you never see his face. You just know this guy, like a monster in any horror movie, cannot be reasoned with. You know, that's what separates it from a suspense thriller. In a suspense thriller, there are potential ways you can outwit or reason with or negotiate with the bad guy, even though that might not work. There are ways to do it. But in a monster movie or a horror story, you can't negotiate with the threat. It is simply you get rid of it, you get away from it, or it overcomes you. So in Duel, this guy, David Mann, you know, a very symbolic name, he's just like a David and Goliath guy who's every one of us and has a challenge. David Mann is getting walked over in life by his wife, by his job, by all these things. He just doesn't know how to stand up to anybody. And then as he's driving on this trip that he didn't want to take but felt like he couldn't say no to, this truck driver threatens him, gets mad at him, and then keeps trying to kill him on the road over and over. And in the end, David Mann has to man up and do things that he would normally have not been able to do in order to get rid of this monster trucker who's trying to kill him. So those are the things where we just see, okay, so if it wasn't for that horror of this psychotic trucker, this guy David Mann would never have become a stronger person.
Wow.
I also think of Jurassic Park, because, you know, people think of horror, and like I say, they only think of horror movies, but Jurassic Park is a horror story. It's primarily science fiction, but it's definitely a horror story because you have all these monster dinosaurs running around that you cannot reason
mm-hmm.
with. You either have to get away from them, which is what they do in the movie, or kill them, or they kill you. Well, what's great about that is when the Tyrannosaurus Rex first shows up, that shows you what horror does with characters. The lawyer who is in the first Jeep is with these two kids. And when the dinosaur,
mm-hmm.
The Tyrannosaurus Rex shows up, he panics, like a lot of us would, and he just takes off and abandons the children, leaving the door open. And of course, he gets eaten, you know, because that's what happens to guys who make the wrong choice. But what's great about it is, I mean, that shows the negative side of this is what happens if you make a bad choice. You know, when you're challenged with something you can't overcome, like a Tyrannosaurus Rex, what are you going to do? And you might have thought you'd be a hero, but when the monster actually shows up, what are you actually made of? And we see the reverse with somebody who does become a hero. Dr. Grant hates kids. He cannot stand
mm-hmm.
being with them. But when the Tyrannosaurus Rex shows up, he risks his life in order to go save the kids from the dinosaur. And then he continues to guide them through the park and becomes like a father to them to make sure that they're safe. Because even though he thought he hated kids, and he kind of did, when the monster shows up and there's a threat, then suddenly he becomes a hero and a protecting father. And again, if it weren't for the Tyrannosaurus Rex threatening them, we wouldn't have known what these people are really like.
I just have going through my head, he left us, he left us. But
yeah.
That's not what I'm going to do.
Exactly. I love, gosh, I can't think of his name now, the guy playing Alan Grant. It was so awesome in that movie.
Is it Sam
Neill?
And
I've seen him in some things. Sam Neill, yeah. And I was excited about him when he was in the movie because I knew him from – I'd seen clips of The Final Conflict, you know, with Damien as Damien, the Omen 3. I just saw, like, parts of him. I was like, wow, that guy's a good actor. And then when
mm-hmm.
he was in Jurassic Park, I'm like, oh, this is great. And everybody's like, what's great? Who's Sam Neill? But, yeah, he's so dramatic in that part. And and Jurassic Park 3 just does a great job.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Again, saving a child.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. But you say now, we talked about horror, but you
mm-hmm.
said your favorite author is Ian Fleming. So tell me how
yeah.
that became your favorite author, how you went from, we've talked about horror, how this thriller now became a part of your life.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, what I do, I write action thrillers that read like blockbuster movies, and I bill myself as a thriller writer. I make it all one word because that just sounds cool. It sounds like a James
mm-hmm.
Bond title. I've always enjoyed James Bond movies, and I started reading some of the books when I was in high school, and I came to discover that something most people don't know, Ian Fleming is a great classic literary author. If I tell people, hey, you know, my favorite author is Ian Fleming, for a lot of people who just know the James Bond movies, that sounds very superficial. But
mm-hmm.
in fact, he's a master of suspense. I've taught some writing classes to people on a kind of volunteer basis, and I've used some examples of some things he did. There's an example in the book Goldfinger where James Bond runs into this guy at an airport and just randomly meets him there. And the guy says, oh, hey, I know you. Aren't you Mr. James Bond? And of course, in the movies, it's like, well, duh, he tells everybody who he is. But in the novels, he's not supposed to actually have people recognize him since he's a spy. And it's brilliant because this guy turns out to be somebody that was in the original Casino Royale novel, the first novel.
Mm-hmm.
And then James Bond remembers him, was like, oh, okay, we casually met. And he says, you know what, I think I have I heard you're some kind of investigator, and I need some help with something. Why don't you come to my house for dinner tonight, and I'll talk to you about it. Well, then Ian Fleming just draws this scene out longer and longer because it's this question that's lingering. Who is this man? What does he want? And is this dangerous? But they sit and they have dinner, and it's this really lavish dinner, and he keeps getting to where he's going to get to the point and say, oh, yes, so anyway, this job I had for you, oh, but wait, let's have some more muffins, you know, or whatever he's ordering. And it's just brilliant because I've seen other people try to do this technique of drawing out a scene, and they're not doing it right. But with Fleming, he knew how to take something that seems very innocuous, like in Moonraker, which I love, the novel. It starts off with this guy, Hugo Drax, who England is relying on to create this new rocket for them that's going to really, you know, boost the country's economy and all these things. So he's seen as the savior and asks James Bond to investigate him. And he's like, well, what's wrong with him? Everything about him seems like he's great. He's a hero. He's like, yeah, the only thing is he cheats at cards. And it's this really simple little thing where there's no reason that this billionaire hero would cheat at cards, and yet he does. And so M asks James Bond to go, since he's a great card player, he asks him to go and basically help Hugo Drax kind of be exposed in a way that won't humiliate him so that he can stop doing this bad habit of cheating. Well, then when they do that, it's like, and that's all it is. It's very innocuous. It's like everyday boring stuff. James Bond is just being asked to do a favor by his boss. It's like, okay, fine. But then when he actually succeeds and Drax knows that Bond has shown people that he's cheating, but it's not necessarily proven, but Drax knows, Drax flips out and he gets in James Bond's face and he says, spend the money quickly, Mr. Bond. And he leaves. It's like, what did that mean? And it continues to snowball into this huge issue where suddenly you realize this started out seeming like an innocent thing, but now suddenly this guy's trying to take over the world or destroy a city or whatever it is. And Ian Fleming did that over and over to just build and build and build something where you kept getting more excitement and more drama and suspense as you went through the novel. And that's what I try to do in my stories, is I want to have some things that are ordinary and everyday drama and humor and family relationships, but there's something going on in the background, similar to what we see in the Harry Potter stories. There's something going on in the background that's very creepy and wrong, and you know that there's a big, big problem that's going on, but you can't figure out what it is yet, and it snowballs to the end of the story.
Can you give us an example from one of your stories where you did something like that?
Yeah, let me think, because, well, like with the Red Rider story, and I don't want to give too much away with this, but, okay, the original Red Rider story, you know, Helena Basque is the 16-year-old Red Riding Hood who ends up fighting werewolves. So in that story, she discovers some things that are going on, that there are people turning themselves into wolves to attack people in her French province. She ends up getting a repeating crossbow weapon and getting a red hooded cloak like she used to wear when she was a child, because after she was attacked by a big wolf and had her face scarred really badly, her parents didn't want her to wear this red cloak anymore that her grandmother made for her. They didn't want to draw attention in any way. They kind of went into hiding so the wolves wouldn't get at them. So when she's a teenager, she finds a cloak similar, and she wears it as a symbol to show herself and the wolves that she's standing up to them. So in the second book, in Red Rider Revolution, she's basically succeeded in the first book, and seems like she has overcome these werewolves. And then in the beginning of the second book, everything is at peace. Everything is like, you know, I mean, people have died, but basically the community is kind of able to start back on its feet and restore itself. And Helena is able to kind of start making friends that she never could make before. And she's starting to feel like she's at home in the community for the first time ever, because since she grew up with scars, she's been considered ugly and outcast her whole life. And so everything seems to be great. And then suddenly things start to, she starts to find out that people are wondering whether she really did all these things that people say she did, whether there really were werewolves. Even though people have seen some of them, they start saying, well, maybe we imagine it. Maybe our minds were playing tricks on us, because how could that have happened? And also because Helena has killed these bad guys, and the last person she killed keeps showing up in town, and she's the only one who sees him. So suddenly it's like, what's going on? Did I really see that person? If I saw that person, did I really kill them? What is going on? Something really bad is going on. And it keeps escalating to the point where people are wondering, okay, has she gone crazy? Has she always been crazy? Or is there anything going on? So that's, and I'll leave that at that point.
Wow, it sounds fascinating. So in this book, she's doing things that normally she wouldn't do. She's killing the werewolf when, as a normal person, as a hero, she wouldn't have done that. So that goes back to how you were describing heroes doing things above and beyond what they would normally do. Wow, that sounds really fascinating.
And that's a big theme in the original Red Rider story, because there's a lot of theme of being isolated and kind of letting yourself become isolated by doing what you know is right when no one else can understand it or go along with it. Helena has this guy who saved her, the woodcutter, is a neighbor, Francois, that she looked up to, because he was a hero who rescued her from the wolf that tried to kill her when she was 7. And she tells him at one point that he is her hero. And he says, well, you know what a hero is? A hero is not somebody who necessarily is big and strong. A hero is somebody who just stands up and does what's right. So that's all I did. All I did was stand up. You just have to stand up and do something. And that becomes the theme of the first story, to stand up and do something, so that when she feels that no one else is dealing with this threat of these wolf attacks, that someone has to do it. And so she convinces her father to train her how to hunt. She convinces Francois, when she's little, to teach her some fighting techniques. And she learns a lot of tricks with this horse. And ultimately, once she's a teenager, she's become strong and very skilled. And she decides to go hunting the wolves herself, because she feels like no one else is doing anything about it.
So,
and she becomes
Red
kind
Rider,
of a pariah.
Red Rider is set in France. How difficult was it to write in another country, basically?
Well, I actually wrote it from home, so I didn't have to go to the other country. But Bram Stoker, who wrote Dracula, was asked about the fact that he never went to Transylvania to learn what the landscape was like to write his story. And he was a little miffed by that. And he said, okay, well, generally speaking, a tree is a tree, a mountain is a mountain, a rock is a rock. And so there's some of that balance that to some degree you have to research and find out, okay, what is the landscape like? If you're writing something that's in Tokyo, you can't act like there's mountains and valleys all over the place when they're only a few hundred miles from the coast. But and my geography is off, so I'm throwing out a few hundred miles. But but you have to know something generally about the area you're dealing with. But then once you have the general layout, then again you're just saying, okay, well, there's valleys and hills, so I'm going to describe valleys and hills, and I'm going to make up some of it, as long as it's generally, a mountainous area or a valley area or something that is correct for that landscape. And some of that, I did make up about half of what's in there in terms of the place names. I actually mingle in like half of the names of provinces that I use are ones that I made up. And then I use some other real provinces like Burgundy and Versailles and some places like that, and Dijon. But the place that she lives in is called La Rue Sauvage, which translates to Wild Street or Wild Path. So that's the central area, and it's set in the eastern part of France, but that's about it. It's I'm just kind of making up that landscape.
How did that work when you wrote High Adventure, The Solomon Ring of Kilimanjaro?
And that was a little different. And that's the reason I don't have book two out for that yet, primarily, is that takes longer to research and write. I made up the place name that they live in, which is Nayura. And that is actually a ruin spelled backwards. And Nayura is just supposed to be a place that's like, oh yeah, no one would want to live there. Nothing is going to grow there. That is the worst place to try and set up anything in Africa. And the idea about High Adventure is it's a combination between Indiana Jones and It's a Wonderful Life. So my main character, Jack Benjamin, is a guy who's like George Bailey, that he's grown up in Africa with his parents as missionaries there, and they pass away, and he feels kind of responsible for that, and he ends up staying behind to oversee the mission when the First World War breaks out and everybody else goes to the war front. So he feels like he's just kind of stuck the same way George Bailey feels stuck in It's a Wonderful Life, because he wants to travel the world in his biplane. So Nayura is the one place name that I made up, and I just kind of, I mean, geographically, it doesn't actually make any sense. I stuck it in the middle of, an area where other things are surrounding it, real places. And I actually was going to use a real place name that I discovered before, that was kind of like a swampland that no longer exists as a name there. But I just kind of decided I didn't want to tie myself down to that specific geography and information that, somebody else would come along at some point and say, yeah, that's not how that place actually works. So, but it's very difficult. It takes a lot of time to research things for a high adventure story, because it's not only researching the places and the information about Africa at that time, but I also need to coordinate the battles of the First World War that were going on in the African colonies, and then tie them into whatever adventure I want to establish with it, and then tie it in with whatever they're seeking, if it's some kind of artifact or anything else. I have ideas planned for different stories that I'm going to do, and hopefully I'll do the next one in the next year or two. But it just takes time to read a lot of books and find out about how to coordinate everything together.
how do you do the research on the different tribes that you have in there and the culture of those tribes?
Well, I've read different books by about Maasai and Kikuyu tribes, and I also read some information for this first book. I read about the Goomba tribe, which is a lost tribe that used to be connected to the Kikuyu tribe a long time ago, and then they kind of disappeared and went extinct. And that's kind of a key part of what's happening in the high adventure book, The Solomon Ring of Kilimanjaro. But yeah, it's kind of funny because I read different books. Some are biographies from people who will just talk about their life and their experience as a Kikuyu, like facing Mount Kenya. Is from a Kikuyu, Jomo Kenyatta. And then I have read a book from a Maasai, Tepelet Ole Saitota. So it just kind of gives you some idea of what is important to them and their perspective of things. And then I've also read some things about Dick Minertegan, who was a British captain during the First World War stationed in Africa, and he's actually a character in the story. And so I read some things about him and some of the crazy things he did that actually one of those is built into that first story about Kilimanjaro.
Which story do you think was more fun to write, the Red Rider or the High Adventure series?
Well, of course, I love all my stories, but the Red Rider really stands out for me of all the stories that I've written because it's the kind of story I always hoped that I would, well, not even hoped that I would be able to write. It's just the kind of story I always have loved in terms of having a legendary hero like Zorro or Robin Hood. But I never, ever imagined that I could ever write something like that at all. I've grown up, you know, on superhero comic books and stories and TV shows and movies. And you know, my favorite hero is Batman. And, you know, basically that's kind of what I'm writing with the Red Rider. But I expected that I'd be writing a superhero story in the future, but I never thought I'd write anything really cool like Zorro or something like that. And when I was really blessed to just kind of land on this idea, it just kind of took off. And it's really like everything that I love about stories. You know, it's got monsters, it's a fairy tale, it's got a girl who's, you know, overcoming bullies in her life, and it's got the legendary hero quality. So all those things, when I started writing it, everything seemed to just flow really easily, and it was really exciting to write, and it's just packed with emotion, like, all the way through. She runs through the gamut of emotions of grief and you know, love and rage and misery and anger, all these things, so it was a blast to write.
Wow. Then you go and you write something different, making fiction funny. Tell us about how you went from these more darker adventures to writing something funny like that.
Well, and that book is adapted from a lesson that I've taught. I mentioned about writing classes that I've done, and I have taught classes on the essential elements of fiction, basically the things that you have to know to write a fiction book. Because I had some people at my church that, in particular, there was one teenage girl who I thought, you know, she's got a lot of writing potential, and she seems to really like it. It would be nice if she just knew what to do with it. And I offered this class to her and to some other people that I thought might be interested. And just came up with a breakdown of these are the things you've got to know in order to write a story. That can be any kind of story. It could be like, hey, I just want to write a story that makes sense to tell to my grandchildren. Or it could be, no, I want to write a story and develop a career as a writer. It's like, whatever you're writing, this is how a story works, and this is how you write a story. So I did that, and then I had some people who wanted more, and so I came up with a actually, the humor book was from that class. I had one lesson that was just about how humor works, and that's not an essential part of writing, but if you know how humor, like if you actually read my cool book and learn the secret of how you create humor, then that, I think, really gives you an edge in making your stories really shine. Because there are some stories that we know, like the Harry Potter series or Buffy the Vampire Slayer or NCIS, where it's like, okay, humor isn't vital to this series. You don't have to have humor for it. But because it has humor and it's such great humor, that makes it leap far above a lot of other similar shows in our minds. You know, we remember it and we relate to it because of all the great humor in it. And humor doesn't mean that you have to be like laugh out loud funny. It just means that it's a way of creating characters and situations that are endearing to people in their minds, where it might be something that's just cute or charming, but those are the things that make us really love characters and scenes in a story.
As a stand-up comedian, I'd be interested, to know how you approach humor just in itself. I mean, how do you approach a situation and try to add humor to it?
Sure. And first, as a writer, and you would have this as a stand-up comedian too, you can't just if you want something to be as funny or as entertaining as possible, you can't just say, okay, we'll just roll with whatever. You want to set it up. So
right.
In a story, the way to create humor, first of all, humor is composed of two elements, and that is I'm trying to think of how this was put. It's been a long time since I wrote that book. It's the contradiction sort of between it's the contrast between what you expect to happen as the reader and what actually happens. That's the central key to humor. So when something is, you know, when something's not funny, then it's usually because, well, we saw that coming. We knew that was going to happen. It's similar to the reaction of fear, you know. In fact, it's a very similar reaction, kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum. So if something scary happens, we gasp. We're like, oh, and we close inward. We hug our arms. We get under a sheet or something because it's like, oh, my gosh, this is scary. I need to fold myself in. The reason we do that is because it's a natural reaction of I feel threatened. Even though it's not really happening, I physically, mentally feel threatened by this thing that scared me. So I'm protecting myself and closing in. When something's funny, it also is a surprise to us, where we didn't expect it to happen. And so something that we didn't expect to happen that entertains us makes us have almost the opposite reaction. Instead of sucking in air, we release air in a laugh. We're like, ah! And we open up our arms and our legs. It's like we feel relaxed because it's this catharsis. Instead of tensing up with fear, we just become totally relaxed with humor. And the more surprising it is, the funnier it is. So it's something where we just that's why humor is so important to people, and that's why TV shows tend to be more focused on humor and sitcoms, because people get home from a long day. They don't always want to have a tense, dramatic thriller. They want something that'll make them laugh and relax after all the other tension in life. So that's one part of it is the key is the contrast between what you expect to happen and then what actually happens. The other part of it is.
I think of it like being sort of like a magician. You mm-hmm. lead them one way and then you take them another. You know what I'm saying? It's misdirection.
Yes.
So
exactly.
That's the way
and
I
that is really important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because as the writer or as the comedian, you are leading your audience where you want them to go, and of course it's like, well, that sounds manipulative. It's like, well, yeah, that's because it is. That's because I'm manipulating you. You know, but you're manipulating them for their good. It's like, you know, I'm writing a story so that my readers can have a really fun, enjoyable experience. So therefore, I would want them to fall in love with my characters. I want them to laugh when my characters do something funny. I want them to, you know, be grieved when my characters have a horrible thing happen to them, you know, and that way you get behind that character and you want them to win. And again, I keep going back to Harry Potter, but Harry Potter's life sucks, you know, and
yeah.
We want his life to improve, you know, and his story at the beginning of the series is completely like Cinderella. It's like, you know, you're stuck with relatives who should love you and care for you, and instead they're treating you like dirt. You need to get out of that horrible, bad family situation. We really feel sorry for you. We really want you to have a better life. We really want you to win. And then all of a sudden, Harry Potter discovers he's the most famous person in the world. He is feared by Voldemort. He is he's got a fortune. He's, you know, he's Mr. Cool suddenly. Just like Cinderella suddenly being at the ball in this beautiful gown and the prince loves her and everything's wonderful. That's what we want, you know. We want to get sucked into a character that we feel bad for, that we admire, that we respect, and then we want them to win.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to create a character that you will love like that and want to win, so that when they win, you feel like, wow, that was such a great story.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it is, you know, we are directing our readers. We're leading them by the nose because they want to be led by the nose. They want to just really really want to have a great experience. But then the other part of humor is first you have the contrast between what people expect to happen, you know, and like you said, you direct them one way and then something different happens. And that's how you set up their surprise for the laugh. The other part of it is commonality, which is simply you can relate to it. So if you have a something that's very funny, like if you look at the newspaper comic strips, okay, there are some comic strips like The Far Side or Calvin and Hobbes that were more funny to my generation. I'm 52 now, and it was like, you know, when those comic strips came out, that was funny to me. Whereas the older mm-hmm. comic strips, like For Better or Worse, it's like, yeah, it's not really very funny to me. Blondie, it's like I get where it's going, but it's sometimes funny, sometimes not. But for my parents' generation, For Better or Worse was hysterical because they could relate to that. They could relate to what that humor was trying to explain. And so that commonality is very important. If you can't relate to what the joke is trying to talk about, then it's just not funny to you. It's funny to someone
mm-hmm.
else, but it will never be funny to you because that's not your common experience.
We're a few years ahead of you, so we understand. I noticed that you have another, just a few years. I do want to spend some time because I know you've got some projects coming up you want to talk about, but I also wanted
sure.
to briefly touch on, we go from the superhero in Red Rider to the high adventure, and then you've got Den. What's
yeah.
that about?
Den is really awesome. I love Den. Thank you for mentioning that. Okay, so this my nephew's been reading my books. So I've been getting those to him, and he's been really enjoying them. He's just in his early 20s, and he said, "Yeah, Den, I think that's your darkest one you've done." And I don't mean it to be dark, actually. And I try to keep things very tame, but Den is, it's kind of like a one-person Hunger Games. It's about this 20-year-old girl who's drop-dead gorgeous. She is a basketball star in college, but she gets expelled for drugs being found in her locker. And she claims that they're steroids. She claims that they're not hers, but nobody believes her. She loses friends and reputation, and she ends up having to take a job at a theme park that's trying to, make a comeback and revive itself. And so this is kind of her way of trying to get back on her feet. She discovers eventually that it's actually a setup, that the theme park is not reopening, but the son of the theme park manager, Gunther Grader, who is infatuated with this girl, Amy Raven, he has set up this whole thing to trap her in a all-night game where she's being hunted by 10 people who want to capture her and keep her.
Mm.
And that's where the dark part comes in. They all have their own, intentions for her in different ways. Most of these guys are sexual predators. Some of them are just, there's a couple of girls who just want to get her and beat her to death. But she has to fight her way past all these people and escape so that she can get out of there. And so it's a very exciting story. The funny thing about this is I knew it was dark. My mom, who is in her early 80s, she loves reading like Amish fiction books, mm-hmm. which, that can only be a genre in Christian market. There's no other, yeah. But anyway,
I'd agree.
I understand having these books, but it's not a genre. That's like having, disco action adventure as a genre in the secular market. But anyway, but she has read like Amish fiction. She reads a lot of Christian historical romances and things. And, and she's wanted to read all my books. She even read Making Fiction Funny, though it has nothing to do with anything she's going to do in life. But, she was like, "Oh, what's this book, Den?" Like, well, that's this book I've written about this girl who's being chased by people, and I don't know if you'd want to read that. And she's like, "Oh, well, all right." Like, well, I mean, you can if you want. Well, she read it. That's her favorite book of mine.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, I was like, "So you like that?" She's like, "Oh, that was great!" And she got on the phone and told her sister about it, and she ordered it for, my nephew, my cousin's kids, and she's like, "Oh, everybody should read this book." So you never know.
I have been taking classes with Ted Decker now, and he talks about writing very dark. It's one way to explore the darkness in us to get it out. And of course, all his books and ours is dark too, and probably yours too. Mm. One thing about writing dark is it makes the light that much brighter.
Yeah, and this is also, I think also this then ended up being a really good theme that I think is actually very good for a lot of Christian readers in particular, even though there's that mm-hmm. dark, undertone of what the bad guy's intentions are. The character Amy Raven, and I picked her name, as kind of, I had to name her Amy as somebody who is being targeted, but who also ends up taking aim at her enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And then her last name Raven, it's like, I thought, cause she is being hunted like a bird, but then she's also ends up kind of turning the tables on her enemies, coming after them, kind of like a bird of prey. So I just thought that kind of worked together well. But she is somebody who she's done everything perfectly as far as anyone would view, you know, what you're supposed to do in life. She's like a straight A student. She's a basketball star. She's just really, she's outstanding as a person. She's the girl that everybody would envy. And on top of all that, she's drop dead gorgeous, you know. She's a Christian, but at the same time, she isn't as strong as she should be or as committed as she should be. She's had, you know, temptations with her boyfriend and has slept with him and stuff, and now she regrets that. But now that all these things have happened, like, she's done everything right, and yet she ends up with steroids in her locker and losing all her friends. Nobody believes her. Her parents think she's lying. And it's like, why is this happening to me? You know, I didn't do anything wrong. And, you know, that's a question that sooner or later we all deal with. It's like, wait a minute. Why is my life going like this right now? I didn't do anything wrong. Why is God punishing me? And it's kind of like, we never necessarily say that, but that's what we're thinking. It's like, shouldn't I have a great life if I do everything right? And we don't recognize that Jesus said, you're going to have trouble in this life. That's it. You're going to have trouble in this life, but take heart because I've overcome the world. So it's not that you'll never have trouble. It's that I'm going to be there with you through the trouble. And with Amy, she comes to discover that, you know, first, she's not as innocent as she assumed she was. But secondly, you know, being a Christian and doing the right things that you should do, that's not insurance to make sure that everything goes the way you want it to in life. And people are just struggling through life and doing the best they can. Nobody's perfect. Nobody's going to be, nobody's going to have a perfect life. But she comes to realize that this idea of perfection and thinking that if you do everything right, that you get this reward of, you know, a perfect life, is just a myth.
Wow. We've kind of gone through a lot of different, we haven't touched on Santa's Chair or Clockwork, which are your short stories. But what I want to do now is talk about, where is Randall Allen Dunn going to go from here? What do you see in the next few years for you?
Well, I'm going to continue with the Red Rider series. There will be a third book. I had hoped to get that out for this October, but it's going to probably be next year. I will get the second High Adventure book out and so on. And what I'm doing next, shortly, hopefully before the year is out, I'm putting out a trilogy called The Island of Mist. It's about a 9-year-old girl who's a Japanese girl who's been adopted by an African-American couple. And she goes searching. They all three go searching for her birth mother in Tokyo. But while they're there at sea, there's a vortex that sweeps them into another world that's filled with the only thing in that world is an island. And it's populated by mythological creatures who have been imprisoned there for almost all time, because the keeper, who is obviously a representation of God, it is God. This is very much like Narnia meets Percy Jackson. But the keeper had created all of these creatures as his servants, just like there are lots of different kinds of angels and living creatures in the Bible. These creatures were all created to be on the earth as guardians and guides for mankind, to help them do what they need to do in following God. But instead of protecting them and serving them like they were supposed to, they ultimately turned against mankind and attacked them or tricked them or whatever. So they were banished to this island. And this 9-year-old girl, Yumiko, discovers later that she's actually there to try and save them and bring them back to Earth. So that's what's coming up next is this three-part book series for middle grade readers.
If somebody wanted to find you or get in touch with you, what's the best way? let's give us some contact information so that people can follow you.
Sure. Well, my website is www.randallallendunn.com, and they can also find me on Facebook. Well, the main thing would be that if you spell my name right, you'll find me. It's I used my full name because my sister-in-law asked me one time what my middle name was, and I told her it's Allen, but it's spelled differently. It's spelled A-L-L-E-N. She's like, oh, mm-hmm. That's really interesting. All three of your names have double letters. Like, they do? Oh, yeah,
oh, yeah,
I see what you
do.
Mean. And then, yeah, and I was like, oh, my gosh, this rolls off the tongue a lot better. I'm going to start using this as my author name because, you know, Randall ends in A-L-L, Allen begins with A-L-L. So it just rolls off the tongue a lot better than using just my first and last name. So it's RANDALLALLENDUNN. And my website is www.randallallendunn.com. And you can also find me online on Facebook. And I'm also on Instagram and Twitter and Pinterest. And I have a YouTube channel.
Oh, really?
Yes, and I'm on Goodreads. I don't do much there.
Okay.
Boy, that's a good question. You know what? You know what I do? Because I don't know how to find myself anywhere online either. I just go and search for my name online, and then if I look for Randall Allen Dunn YouTube and see if I can find myself. So that's how helpful I am.
Well, Randall, we very much enjoyed talking to you. I will be getting some of your books, so I'll be contacting you to see what we can I'd like to get some autographed books from you, and I'll be contacting
sure.
you about that. But very much enjoyed talking to you, and want to see great things coming from you.
Well, thank you. I had a great time here. Thank you both for having me on the show.
Good luck to you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.